But in adult life it has 100 fine names. Achilles' wrath, Coriolanus's grandeur, revenge and injured merit and self-respect and tragic greatness and proper pride. Then is no one lost through the undignified vices, sir? Through mere sensuality? Some are, no doubt. The sensualist, I'll allow ye, begins by pursuing a real pleasure, though a small one. His sin is the less. But the time comes on when, though the pleasure becomes less and less, and the craving fiercer and fiercer, and though he knows that joy can never come that way, yet he prefers to joy the mere fondling of unappeasable lust, and would not have it taken from him. He'd fight to the death to keep it. He'd like well to be able to scratch, but even when he can scratch no more, he'd rather itch than not. He was silent for a few minutes, and then began again. You'll understand, there are innumerable forms of this choice. Sometimes forms that one hardly thought of at all on earth. There was a creature came here not long ago and went back. Sir Archibald, they called him. In his early life, he'd been interested in nothing but survival. He'd written a whole shelf full of books about it. He began by being philosophical, but in the end he took up psychical research. It grew to be his only occupation. Experimenting, lecturing, running a magazine, and travelling too, digging out queer stories among Tibetan lamas, and being initiated into brotherhoods in Central Africa. Proofs and more proofs, and then more proofs again were what he wanted. It drove him mad if ever he saw anyone taking an interest in anything else. He got into trouble during one of your wars for running up and down the country telling them not to fight because it wasted a lot of money that ought to be spent on research. Well, in good time, the poor creature died and came here, and there was no power in the universe that would have prevented him staying and going on to the mountains. But do you think that did him any good? This country was no use to him at all. Everyone here had survived already. Nobody took the least interest in the question. There was nothing more to prove. His occupation was clean gone. Of course, if he would only have admitted that he'd mistaken the means for the end, and had a good laugh at himself, he could have begun all over again like a little child, and entered into joy. But he would not do that. He cared nothing about joy. In the end he went away. "How fantastic," said I. "Do you think so?" said the teacher, with a piercing glance. "It is nearer to such as you than you think. There have been men before now who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself, as if the good Lord had nothing to do but exist. There have been some who were so occupied in spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ. Man, you see it in smaller matters. Did you never know a lover of books that with all his first editions and signed copies had lost the power to read them? Or an organizer of charities that had lost all love for the poor? It is the subtlest of all the snares." Moved by a desire to change the subject, I asked why the solid people, since they were full of love, did not go down into hell to rescue the ghosts. Why were they content simply to meet them on the plain? One would have expected a more militant charity. "You will understand that better, perhaps, before you go," said he. "In the meantime, I must tell ye they have come further for the sake of the ghosts than ye can understand. Every one of us lives only to journey further and further into the mountains. Every one of us has interrupted that journey and retraced immeasurable distances to come down today on the mere chance of saving some ghosts. Of course, it is also joy to do so, but ye cannot blame us for that. And it would be no use to come further, even if it were possible. The sane would do no good if they made themselves mad to help madmen." "But what of the poor ghosts, who never get into the omnibus at all?" "Everyone who wishes it does, never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, 'Thy will be done,' and those to whom God says, in the end, 'Thy will be done.' All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened." At this moment we were suddenly interrupted by the thin voice of a ghost talking at an enormous speed. Looking behind us, we saw the creature. It was addressing one of the solid people and was doing so too busily to notice us. Every now and then the solid spirit tried to get in a word, but without success. The ghost's talk was like this.
"Oh, my dear, I've had such a dreadful time. I don't know how I ever got here at all. I was coming with Eleanor Stone, and we'd arranged the whole thing, and we were to meet at the corner of Sink Street. I made it perfectly plain, because I knew what she was like, and if I told her once, I told her 100 times I would not meet her outside that dreadful Marjorie Banks woman's house, not after the way she'd treated me. That was one of the most dreadful things that happened to me. I've been dying to tell you, because I felt sure you'd tell me I acted rightly. No, wait a moment, dear, till I've told you. I tried living with her when I first came, and it was all fixed up, and she was to do the cooking, and I was to look after the house, and I did think I was going to be comfortable after all I'd been through, but she turned out to be so changed, absolutely selfish, and not a particle of sympathy for anyone but herself. And as I once said to her, I do think I'm entitled to a little consideration, because you at least lived out your time, but I oughtn't to have been here for years and years yet. But of course, I'm forgetting you don't know. I was murdered, simply murdered, dear. That man should never have operated. I ought to be alive today, and they simply starved me in that dreadful nursing home, and no one ever came near me, and—"
The shrill, monotonous whine died away as the speaker, still accompanied by the bright patience at her side, moved out of hearing.
"What troubles you, son?" asked my teacher.
"I am troubled, sir," said I, "because that unhappy creature doesn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be even in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly, garrulous old woman who has got into a habit of grumbling, and one feels that a little kindness and rest and change would put her all right.
That is what she once was. That is maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler."
I should have thought there was no doubt about that.
"Aye, but you misunderstand me. The question is whether she is a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman, even the least trace of one still there inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. And if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go on blowing them in our own eyes forever. They must be swept up."
"But how can there be a grumble without a grumbler?"
"The whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. But you'll have had experiences. It begins with a grumbling mood, and yourself still distinct from it, perhaps criticizing it, and yourself in a dark hour may will that mood, embrace it. You can repent and come out of it again, but there may come a day when you can do that no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood, nor even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. But come, you are here to watch and listen. Lean on my arm, and we will go for a little walk."
I obeyed. To lean on the arm of someone older than myself was an experience that carried me back to childhood, and with this support I found the going tolerable, so much so indeed that I flattered myself my feet were already growing more solid, until a glance at the poor transparent shapes convinced me that I owed all this ease to the strong arm of the teacher. Perhaps it was because of his presence that my other senses also appeared to be quickened. I noticed scents in the air which had hitherto escaped me, and the country put on new beauties. There was water everywhere, and tiny flowers quivering in the early breeze. Far off in the woods we saw the deer glancing past, and once a sleek panther came purring to my companion's side. We also saw many of the ghosts. I think the most pitiable was a female ghost. Her trouble was the very opposite of that which afflicted the other, the lady frightened by the unicorns. This one seemed quite unaware of her phantasmal appearance. More than one of the solid people tried to talk to her, and at first I was quite at a loss to understand her behaviour to them. She appeared to be contorting her all but invisible face, and writhing her smoke-like body in a quite meaningless fashion. At last I came to the conclusion, incredible as it seemed, that she supposed herself still capable of attracting them, and was trying to do so. She was a thing that had become incapable of conceiving conversation save as a means to that end. If a corpse, already liquid with decay, had arisen from the coffin, smeared its gums with lipstick, and attempted a flirtation, the result could not have been more appalling. In the end she muttered, "Stupid creatures," and turned back to the bus. This put me in mind to ask my teacher what he thought of the affair with the unicorns.
"It will maybe have succeeded," he said. "You will have divined that he meant to frighten her. Not that fear itself could make her less a ghost, but if it took her mind a moment off herself, there might in that moment be a chance. I have seen them saved so." We met several ghosts that had come so near to heaven only in order to tell the celestials about hell. Indeed, this is one of the commonest types. Others who had perhaps been, like myself, teachers of some kind, actually wanted to give lectures about it. They brought fat notebooks full of statistics and maps, and one of them a magic lantern. Some wanted to tell anecdotes of the notorious sinners of all ages whom they had met below. But the most part seemed to think that the mere fact of having contrived for themselves so much misery gave them a kind of superiority. "You have led a sheltered life," they bawled. "You don't know the seamy side. We'll tell you. We'll give you some hard facts." As if to tinge heaven with infernal images and colours had been the only purpose for which they came. All alike, so far as I could judge from my own exploration of the lower world, were wholly unreliable, and all equally incurious about the country in which they had arrived. They repelled every attempt to teach them, and when they found that nobody listened to them, they went back, one by one, to the bus. This curious wish to describe hell turned out, however, to be only the mildest form of a desire very common among the ghosts, the desire to extend hell, to bring it bodily, if they could, into heaven. There were tub-thumping ghosts who in thin, bat-like voices urged the blessed spirits to shake off their fetters, to escape from their imprisonment in happiness, to tear down the mountains with their hands, to seize heaven for their own. Hell offered her cooperation. There were planning ghosts who implored them to dam the river, cut down the trees, kill the animals, build a mountain railway, smooth out the horrible grass and moss and heather with asphalt. There were materialistic ghosts who informed the immortals that they were deluded. There was no life after death, and this whole country was a hallucination. There were ghosts, plain and simple, mere bogies, fully conscious of their own decay, who had accepted the traditional role of the spectre and seemed to hope they could frighten someone. I had had no idea that this desire was possible. But my teacher reminded me that the pleasure of frightening is by no means unknown on earth, and also of Tacitus's saying, "They terrify lest they should fear." When the debris of a decayed human soul finds itself crumbled into ghosthood and realizes, "I myself am now that which all humanity has feared. I am just that cold churchyard shadow, that horrible thing which cannot be, yet somehow is," then to terrify others appears to it an escape from the doom of being a ghost, yet still fearing ghosts, fearing even the ghost it is, for to be afraid of oneself is the last horror. But beyond all these, I saw other grotesque phantoms in which hardly a trace of the human form remained. Monsters who had faced the journey to the bus stop, perhaps for them it was thousands of miles, and come up to the country of the shadow of life and limped far into it over the torturing grass, only to spit and gibber out in one ecstasy of hatred their envy and, what is harder to understand, their contempt of joy. The voyage seemed to them a small price to pay if once, only once, within sight of that eternal dawn, they could tell the prigs, the toffs, the sanctimonious humbugs, the snobs, the haves, what they thought of them. "How do they come to here at all?" I asked my teacher. "I have seen that kind converted," said he, "when those ye would think less deeply damned have gone back. Those that hate goodness are sometimes nearer than those that know nothing at all about it, and think they have it already." "Whisht now," said my teacher suddenly. We were standing close to some bushes, and beyond them I saw one of the solid people and a ghost who had apparently just that moment met. The outlines of the ghost looked vaguely familiar, but I soon realized that what I had seen on earth was not the man himself, but photographs of him in the papers. He had been a famous artist."
"God," said the ghost, glancing round the landscape.
"God what?" asked the spirit.
"What do you mean, God what?" asked the ghost.
"In our grammar, God is a noun."
"Oh, I see. I only meant by gum, or something of the sort. I meant, well, all this. I should like to paint this."
"I shouldn't bother about that just at present, if I were you.
Look here, isn't one going to be allowed to go on painting?"
"Looking comes first."
"But I've had my look. I've seen just what I want to do. God! I wish I thought of bringing my things with me."
The spirit shook his head, scattering light from his hair as he did so. "That sort of thing's no good here," he said.
"What do you mean?" said the ghost.
"When you painted on earth, at least in your earlier days, it was because you caught glimpses of heaven in the earthly landscape. The success of your painting was that it enabled others to see the glimpses too. But here you are having the thing itself. It is from here that the messages came. There is no good telling us about this country, for we see it already. In fact, we see it better than you do."
"Then there's never going to be any point in painting here?"
"I don't say that. When you've grown into a person, it's all right, we all had to do it. There'll be some things which you'll see better than anyone else. One of the things you'll want to do will be to tell us about them, but not yet. At present your business is to see. Come and see. He is endless. Come and feed." There was a little pause.
"That will be delightful," said the ghost presently, in a rather dull voice.
"Come then," said the spirit, offering it his arm.
"How soon do you think I could begin painting?" it asked.
The spirit broke into laughter.
"Don't you see you'll never paint at all, if that's what you're thinking about?" he said.
"What do you mean?" asked the ghost.
"Why, if you're interested in the country only for the sake of painting it, you'll never learn to see the country."
"But that's just how a real artist is interested in the country."
"No, you're forgetting," said the spirit. "That was not how you began. Light itself was your first love. You loved paint only as a means of telling about light."
"Oh, that's ages ago," said the ghost. "One grows out of that. Of course, you haven't seen my later works. One becomes more and more interested in paint for its own sake."
"One does, indeed. I also have had to recover from that. It was all a snare. Ink and catgut and paint were necessary down there, but they are also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from love of the thing he tells to love of the telling, till, down in deep hell, they cannot be interested in God at all, but in only what they say about him. For it doesn't stop at being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower, become interested in their own personalities, and then in nothing but their own reputations."
"I don't think I'm much troubled in that way," said the ghost stiffly.
"That's excellent," said the spirit. "Not many of us had quite got over it when we first arrived, but if there is any of that inflammation left, it will be cured when you come to the fountain."
"What fountain's that?"
"It is up there in the mountains," said the spirit, "very cold and clear, between two green hills, a little like Leith. When you have drunk of it, you forget forever all proprietorship in your own works. You enjoy them just as if they were someone else's, without pride and without modesty."
"That'll be grand," said the ghost, without enthusiasm.
"Well, come," said the spirit, and for a few paces he supported the hobbling shadow forward to the east.
"Of course," said the ghost, as if speaking to itself, "there'll always be interesting people to meet."
"Everyone will be interesting."
"Oh, ah, yes, to be sure. I was thinking of people in our own line. Shall I meet Claude, or Cézanne, or—"
"Sooner or later, if they're here."
"But don't you know?"
"Well, of course not. I've only been here a few years. All the chances are against my having run across them. There are a good many of us, you know."
"But surely in the case of distinguished people you'd hear?"
"But they aren't distinguished. No more than anyone else. Don't you understand? The glory flows into everyone, and back from everyone, like light and mirrors. But the light's the thing."
"Do you mean there are no famous men?"
"They are all famous. They are all known, remembered, recognized by the only mind that can give a perfect judgment."
Of course, in that sense," said the ghost.
"Don't stop," said the spirit, making to lead him still forward.
"One must be content with one's reputation among posterity, then," said the ghost.
"My friend," said the spirit, "don't you know?"
"Know what?"
"That you and I are already completely forgotten on the earth."
"Eh? What's that?" exclaimed the ghost, disengaging its arm. "Do you mean those damned neo-regionalists have won after all?"
"Lord love you, yes," said the spirit, once more shaking and shining with laughter.
"You couldn't get £5 for any picture of mine, or even of yours, in Europe or America today. We're dead out of fashion." "I must be off at once," said the ghost. "Let me go. Damn it all, one has one's duty to the future of art. I must go back to my friends. I must write an article. There must be a manifesto. We must start a periodical. We must have publicity. Let me go. This is beyond a joke.
And without listening to the spirit's reply, the spectre vanished. Chapter 10. This conversation also we overheard.
"That is quite out of the question," said a female ghost to one of the bright women. "I should not dream of staying if I'm expected to meet Robert. I'm ready to forgive him, of course, but anything more is quite impossible. How he comes to be here, but that is your affair." "But if you have forgiven him," said the other, "surely I forgive him as a Christian," said the ghost, "but there are some things one can never forget."
"But I don't understand," began the she-spirit.
"Exactly," said the ghost with a little laugh. "You never did. You always thought Robert could do no wrong. I know. Please don't interrupt for one moment. You haven't the faintest conception of what I went through with your dear Robert. The ingratitude! It was I who made a man of him, sacrificed my whole life to him, and what was my reward? Absolute, utter selfishness. No, but listen. He was pottering along on about 600 a year when I married him, and mark my words, Hilda, he'd have been in that position to the day of his death if it hadn't been for me. It was I who had to drive him every step of the way. He hadn't a spark of ambition. It was like trying to lift a sack of coal. I had to positively nag him to take on that extra work in the other department, though it was really the beginning of everything for him. The laziness of men. He said, if you please, he couldn't work more than 13 hours a day, as if I weren't working far longer, for my day's work wasn't over when his was. I had to keep him going all evening, if you understand what I mean. If he'd had his way, he'd have just sat in an armchair and sulked when dinner was over. It was I who had to draw him out of himself and brighten him up and make conversation. With no help from him, of course. Sometimes he didn't even listen. As I said to him, I should have thought good manners, if nothing else. He seemed to have forgotten that I was a lady, even if I had married him, and all the time I was working my fingers to the bone for him, and without the slightest appreciation. I used to spend simply hours arranging flowers to make that poky little house nice, and instead of thanking me, what do you think he said? Said he wished I wouldn't fill up the writing desk with them when he wanted to use it. And there was a perfectly frightful fuss one evening because I'd spilled one of the vases over some papers of his. It was all nonsense, really, because they weren't anything to do with his work. He had some silly idea of writing a book in those days, as if he could. I cured him of that in the end. No, Hilda, you must listen to me. The trouble I went to entertaining. Robert's idea was that he'd just slink off by himself every now and then to see what he called his old friends, and leave me to amuse myself. But I knew from the first that those friends were doing him no good. No, Robert, said I, your friends are now mine. It is my duty to have them here, however tired I am, and however little we can afford it. You'd have thought that would have been enough, but they did come for a bit. That is where I had to use a certain amount of tact. A woman who has her wits about her can always drop in a word here and there. I wanted Robert to see them against a different background. They weren't quite at their ease, somehow, in my drawing-room, nor at their best. I couldn't help laughing sometimes. Of course, Robert was uncomfortable while the treatment was going on, but it was all for his own good in the end. None of that set were friends of his any longer by the end of the first year. And then he got the new job. A great step up. But what do you think? Instead of realizing that we now had a chance to spread out a bit, all he said was, "Well, now, for God's sake, let's have some peace." That nearly finished me. I nearly gave him up altogether, but I knew my duty. I've always done my duty. You can't believe the work I had getting him to agree to a bigger house, and then finding a house. I wouldn't have grudged it one scrap if only he'd taken it in the right spirit, if only he'd seen the fun of it all. If he'd been a different sort of man, it would have been fun meeting him on the doorstep as he came back from the office and saying, "Come along, Bobs, no time for dinner tonight. I've just heard of a house out near Watford, and I've got the keys, and we can get there and back by 1 o'clock. But with him, it was perfect misery, Hilda, for by this time your wonderful Robert was turning into the sort of man who cares about nothing but food. When I got him into the new house at last, yes, I know, it was a little more than we could really afford at the moment, but all sorts of things were opening out before him, and, of course, I began to entertain properly. No more of his sort of friends, thank you. I was doing it all for his sake. Every useful friend he ever made was due to me. Naturally, I had to dress well. They ought to have been the happiest years of both our lives. If they weren't, he had no one but himself to thank. Oh, he was a maddening man, simply maddening. He just set himself to get old and silent and grumpy, just sank into himself. He could have looked years younger if he'd taken the trouble. "'He needn't have walked with a stoop. "'I'm sure I warned him about that often enough. "'He was the most miserable host. "'Whenever we gave a party, everything rested on my shoulders. "'Robert was simply a wet blanket. "'As I said to him, and if I said it once, I said it 100 times, "'he hadn't always been like that. "'There had been a time when he took an interest in all sorts of things "'and had been quite ready to make friends. "'What on earth is coming over you?' I used to say. "'But now he just didn't answer at all.' He would sit staring at me with his great big eyes. I came to hate a man with dark eyes, and, I know it now, just hating me. That was my reward. After all I'd done, sheer, wicked, senseless hatred, at the very moment when he was a richer man than he'd ever dreamed of being, as I used to say to him, "Robert, you're simply letting yourself go to seed." The younger men who came to the house, it wasn't my fault if they liked me better than my old bear of a husband, used to laugh at him. I did my duty to the very end. I forced him to take exercise. That was really my chief reason for keeping a Great Dane. I kept on giving parties. I took him for the most wonderful holidays. I saw that he didn't drink too much. Even when things became desperate, I encouraged him to take up his writing again. It couldn't do any harm by then. How could I help it if he did have a nervous breakdown in the end? My conscience is clear. I've done my duty by him, if ever a woman has. So you see why it would be impossible to... And yet I don't know. I believe I have changed my mind. I'll make them a fair offer, Hilda. I will not meet him if it means just meeting him and no more. But if I'm given a free hand, I'll take charge of him again. I will take up my burden once more. But I must have a free hand. With all the time one would have here, I believe I could make something of him. Somewhere quite to ourselves. Wouldn't that be a good plan? "'He's not fit to be on his own. "'Put me in charge of him. "'He wants firm handling. "'I know him better than you do. "'What's that? "'No, give him to me, do you hear? "'Don't consult him. "'Just give him to me. "'I'm his wife, aren't I? "'I was only beginning. "'There's lots, lots, lots of things I still want to do with him. "'No, listen, Hilda. "'Please, please. "'I'm so miserable. "'I must have someone to do things to. "'It's simply frightful down there. "'No one minds about me at all. "'I can't alter them. "'It's dreadful to see them all sitting about "'and not be able to do anything with them. "'Give him back to me. "'Why should he have everything his own way? "'It's no good for him. "'It isn't right. "'It's not fair. "'I want Robert. "'What right have you to keep him from me? "'I hate you. "'How can I pay him out if you won't let me have him?' The ghost, which had towered up like a dying candle flame, snapped suddenly. A sour, dry smell lingered in the air for a moment, and then there was no ghost to be seen. Chapter 11. One of the most painful meetings we witnessed was between a woman's ghost and a bright spirit who had apparently been her brother. They must have met only a moment before we ran across them, for the ghost was just saying in a tone of unconcealed disappointment, "Oh, Reginald, it's you, is it?" "Yes, dear," said the spirit. "I know you expected someone else. Can you... I hope you can be a little glad to see even me for the present."
"I did think Michael would have come," said the ghost, and then, almost fiercely, "he is here, of course."
"He's there, far up in the mountains."
"Why hasn't he come to meet me? Didn't he know?"
"My dear, don't worry. It will all come right presently. It wouldn't have done. Not yet. He wouldn't be able to see or hear you as you are at present. You'd be totally invisible to Michael, but we'll soon build you up."
"I should have thought if you can see me, my own son could."
"It doesn't always happen like that. You see, I have specialized in this sort of work."
"Oh, it's work, is it?" snapped the ghost.
Then, after a pause,
"Well, when am I going to be allowed to see him?"
"There's no question of being allowed, Pam. As soon as it's possible for him to see you, of course he will. You need to be thickened up a bit."
"How?"
said the ghost. The monosyllable was hard and a little threatening. "I'm afraid the first step is a hard one," said the spirit. "But after that you'll go on like a house on fire. You will become solid enough for Michael to perceive you when you learn to want someone else besides Michael. I don't say more than Michael, not as a beginning. That will come later. It's only the little germ of a desire for God that we need to start the process."
"Oh, you mean religion and all that sort of thing. This is hardly the moment. And from you, of all people. Well, never mind. I'll do whatever's necessary. What do you want me to do?"
"Come on.
The sooner I begin it, the sooner they'll let me see my boy. I'm quite ready.
But, Pam, do think. Don't you see you are not beginning at all as long as you are in that state of mind? You're treating God only as a means to Michael. But the whole thickening treatment consists in learning to want God for his own sake.
You wouldn't talk like that if you were a mother.
You mean if I were only a mother? But there is no such thing as being only a mother. You exist as Michael's mother only because you first exist as God's creature. That relation is older and closer. No, listen, Pam. He also loves. He also has suffered. He also has waited a long time.
If he loved me, he'd let me see my boy. If he loved me, why did he take away Michael from me? I wasn't going to say anything about that, but it's pretty hard to forgive, you know.
But he had to take Michael away, partly for Michael's sake.
I'm sure I did my best to make Michael happy. I gave up my whole life.
Human beings can't make one another really happy for long. And secondly, for your sake. He wanted your merely instinctive love for your child. Tigresses share that, you know. To turn into something better. He wanted you to love Michael as he understands love. You cannot love a fellow creature fully till you love God. Sometimes this conversion can be done while the instinctive love is still gratified. But there was, it seems, no chance of that in your case. The instinct was uncontrolled and fierce and monomaniac. Ask your daughter, or your husband. Ask your own mother. You haven't once thought of her. The only remedy was to take away its object. It was a case for surgery. When that first kind of love was thwarted, then there was just a chance that in the loneliness, in the silence, something else might begin to grow.
This is all nonsense, cruel and wicked nonsense. What right have you to say things like that about mother love? It is the highest and holiest feeling in human nature.
Pam, Pam, no natural feelings are high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. They are all holy when God's hand is on the rein. They all go bad when they set up on their own and make themselves into false gods.
My love for Michael would never have gone bad, not if we'd lived together for millions of years.
You are mistaken, and you must know. Haven't you met, down there, mothers who have their sons with them in hell? Does their love make them happy?
If you mean people like the Guthrie woman and her dreadful Bobby, of course not. I hope you're not suggesting... If I had Michael, I'd be perfectly happy, even in that town. I wouldn't be always talking about him till everyone hated the sound of his name, which is what Winifred Guthrie does about her brat. I wouldn't quarrel with people for not taking enough notice of him and then be furiously jealous if they did. I wouldn't go about whining and complaining that he wasn't nice to me, because, of course, he would be nice. Don't you dare to suggest that Michael could ever become like the Guthrie boy. There are some things I won't stand.
What you have seen in the Guthries is what natural affection turns to in the end, if it will not be converted.
It's a lie, a wicked, cruel lie. How could anyone love their son more than I did? Haven't I lived only for his memory all these years?
That was rather a mistake, Pam. In your heart of hearts, you know it was.
What was a mistake?
All that 10 years' ritual of grief, keeping his room exactly as he'd left it, keeping anniversaries, refusing to leave that house, though Dick and Muriel were both wretched there.
Of course they didn't care. I know that. I soon learned to expect no real sympathy from them.
You're wrong. No man ever felt his son's death more than Dick. Not many girls loved their brothers better than Muriel. It wasn't against Michael they revolted. It was against you. Against having their whole life dominated by the tyranny of the past, and not really even Michael's past, but your past.
You are heartless. Everyone is heartless. The past was all I had.
It was all you chose to have. It was the wrong way to deal with a sorrow. It was Egyptian, like embalming a dead body.
Of course I'm wrong. Everything I say or do is wrong, according to you.
But of course, said the spirit, shining with love and mirth, so that my eyes were dazzled. That's what we all find when we reach this country. We've all been wrong. That's the great joke. There's no need to go on pretending one was right. After that, we begin living.
How dare you laugh about it? Give me my boy, do you hear? I don't care about all your rules and regulations. I don't believe in a God who keeps mother and son apart. I believe in a God of love. No one has a right to come between me and my son. Not even God. Tell him that to his face. I want my boy, and I mean to have him. He is mine, do you understand? Mine, mine, mine. Forever and ever.
He will be, Pam. Everything will be yours. God himself will be yours. But not that way. Nothing can be yours by nature.
What? Not my own son, born out of my own body?
And where is your own body now? Didn't you know that nature draws to an end? Look, the sun is coming, over the mountains there. It will be up any moment now.
Michael is mine.
How, yours? You didn't make him. Nature made him to grow in your body without your will, even against your will. You sometimes forget that you didn't intend to have a baby then at all. Michael was originally an accident.
Who told you that?
Said the ghost, and then, recovering itself,
it's a lie. It's not true, and it's no business of yours. I hate your religion, and I hate and despise your God. I believe in a God of love.
And yet, Pam, you have no love at this moment for your own mother, or for me.
Oh, I see. That's the trouble, is it? Really, Reginald, the idea of your being hurt because—
Lord love you, said the spirit with a great laugh. You needn't bother about that. Don't you know that you can't hurt anyone in this country? The ghost was silent and open-mouthed for a moment, more wilted, I thought, by this reassurance than by anything else that had been said.
Come, we will go a bit further, said my teacher, laying his hand on my arm.
Why did you bring me away, sir? Said I, when we had passed out of earshot of this unhappy ghost.
It might take a long while, that conversation, said my teacher, and you have heard enough to see what the choice is.
Is there any hope for her, sir?
Aye, there's some. What she calls her love for her son has turned into a poor, prickly, astringent sort of thing. But there's still a wee spark of something that's not just herself in it. That might be blown into a flame.
Then some natural feelings are really better than others. I mean, are a better starting point for the real thing.
Better and worse. There's something in natural affection which will lead it on to eternal love more easily than natural appetite could be led on. But there's also something in it which makes it easier to stop at the natural level and mistake it for the heavenly. Brass is mistaken for gold more easily than glass is mistaken for gold more easily than clay is. And if it finally refuses conversion, its corruption will be worse than the corruption of what you call the lower passions. It is a stronger angel, and therefore, when it falls, a fiercer devil.
I don't know that I dare repeat this on earth, sir, said I. They'd say I was inhuman. They'd say I believed in total depravity. They'd say I was attacking the best and the holiest things. They'd call me.
It might do you no harm if they did, said he with, I really thought, a twinkle in his eye.
But could one dare— Could one have the face to go to a bereaved mother in her misery when one's not bereaved oneself?
No, no, son, that's no office of yours. You're not a good enough man for that. When your own heart's been broken, it will be time for you to think of talking. But someone must see in general what's been unsaid among you this many a year, that love, as mortals understand the word, isn't enough. Every natural love will rise again and live forever in this country, but none will rise again until it has been buried.
The saying is almost too hard for us.
Ah, but it's cruel not to say it. They that know have grown afraid to speak. That is why sorrows that used to purify now only fester.
Keats was wrong, then, when he said he was certain of the holiness of the heart's affections.
I doubt if he knew clearly what he meant. But you and I must be clear. There is but one good, and that is God. Everything else is good when it looks to him, and bad when it turns from him. And the higher and mightier it is in the natural order, the more demoniac it will be if it rebels. It's not out of bad mice or bad fleas you make demons, but out of bad archangels. The false religion of lust is baser than the false religion of mother love, or patriotism, or art. But lust is less likely to be made into a religion. But look.
I saw coming towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all the ghosts, he was unsubstantial, but they differed from one another as smokes differ.
Some had been whitish. This one was dark and oily. What sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip and whispering things in his ear. As we caught sight of him, he turned his head to the reptile with a snarl of impatience.
"Shut up, I tell you," he said.
It wagged its tail and continued to whisper to him. He ceased snarling and presently began to smile. Then he turned and started to limp westward, away from the mountains.
"Off so soon?" said a voice.
The speaker was more or less human in shape, but larger than a man, and so bright that I could hardly look at him. His presence smote on my eyes and on my body, too, for there was heat coming from him as well as light, like the morning sun at the beginning of a tyrannous summer day.
"Yes, I'm off," said the ghost. "Thanks for all your hospitality, but it's no good, you see. I told this little chap—here he indicated the lizard—that he'd have to be quiet if he came, which he insisted on doing. Of course his stuff won't do here, I realize that, but he won't stop. I shall just have to go home."
"Would you like me to make him quiet?" said the flaming spirit.
An angel, as I now understood.
"Of course I would," said the ghost.
"Then I will kill him," said the angel, taking a step forward.
"Oh, look out! You're burning me! Keep away!" said the ghost, retreating.
"Don't you want him killed?"
"You didn't say anything about killing him at first. I hardly meant to bother you with anything so drastic as that."
"It's the only way," said the angel, whose burning hands were now very close to the lizard. "Shall I kill it?"
"Well, that's a further question. I'm quite open to consider it, but it's a new point, isn't it? I mean, for the moment I was only thinking about silencing it, because up here, well, it's so damned embarrassing."
"May I kill it?"
"Well, there's time to discuss that later."
"There is no time. May I kill it?"
"Please, I never meant to be such a nuisance. Please, really, don't bother. Look, it's gone to sleep of its own accord. I'm sure it'll be all right now, thanks ever so much."
"May I kill it?"
"Honestly, I don't think there's the slightest necessity for that. I'm sure I shall be able to keep it in order now. I think the gradual process would be far better than killing it."
"The gradual process is of no use at all."
"Don't you think so? Well, I'll think over what you've said very carefully. I honestly will. In fact, I'd let you kill it now, but as a matter of fact, I'm not feeling frightfully well today. It would be silly to do it now. I'd need to be in good health for the operation. Some other day, perhaps."
"There is no other day. All days are present now."
"Get back! You're burning me. How can I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did."
"It is not so."
"Why, you're hurting me now."
"I never said it wouldn't hurt you. I said it wouldn't kill you."
"Oh, I know. You think I'm a coward. But it isn't that. Really, it isn't. I say, let me run back by tonight's bus and get an opinion from my own doctor. I'll come again the first moment I can."
"This moment contains all moments."
"Why are you torturing me? You're jeering at me. How can I let you tear me to pieces? If you wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damn thing without asking me, before I knew? It would be all over by now if you had."
"I cannot kill it against your will."